Okay, ladies and gentlemen, our 10-minute speaker, Keith, has graciously accepted.
All right.
Give him a Tulare County welcome.
My name is Keith, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Keith.
Grateful to be sober today. You know, one thing I know for sure that I woke up this morning, I didn't come to, and I woke up sober, and I've been sober a number of years now. My sobriety date is November 24th, 2000. I think back at there was a long period of time where I didn't drink, and I didn't want to go to Alcoholics Anonymous. Drinking has become a problem in my marriage, in my furthering my career, so I just stopped drinking. I didn't need anybody's help. I went 7 or 8 years without a drink. Between the ages of my mid-20s to my mid-30s, or early 30s, and, I'd gone to Alcoholics Anonymous in my early 20s, and I wasn't really convinced I was an alcoholic. I thought the circumstances, I was in the wrong place, the wrong time, possibly, or I don't know what I wasn't done, basically, done drinking. I didn't think I was an alcoholic. I didn't really want to be an alcoholic. I volunteered for this 28-day treatment program to get out of the trouble that I'd gotten into. I was in the service at the time, and it worked. You know, I got the heat off my back, so and I continued drinking until I got an honorable discharge from the Navy, and I got married, started a new career in the civilian world, and drinking had become a nuisance to my now ex, but and it became a nuisance to my employer, so I just quit drinking. And I was offered some help, and I said, no, I can do it on my own. And then came the day when I was offered a drink, and I told them about the trouble I'd gotten into years prior and how it caused problems in my life. And he said, oh, you're probably cured by now. And I was pretty thirsty, so that's all I needed to hear is someone validate my thinking that I thought I was okay. And, within a short period of time, my drinking was out of control, and here I am, here 17 years later, since the time, the sheriff's deputies showed up my door one day. It was on a Thanksgiving day, and they asked me, the first question they asked me, how much I'd had to drink that day, and they said, I haven't been drinking at all, officers, well, have you looked in the mirror? Because I stumbled and hit the bumper of the vehicle I was driving. Had huge gash under my left eye. My left eye was swollen shut. And when I did finally look in the mirror and I saw the person I become, the lying, cheating, thieving, because I was stealing time from my kids. They were 5 and 9 at the time, and I was stealing time from the employer. And I was basically working a side job on the weekends just to support my drinking. So I was stealing money away from my money that could have gone to my family. I was drinking it. This old timer, he had about 20 years when I sobered up, and I was feeling pretty bad and pretty miserable. Feeling guilty and remorseful and all, feeling desperate. And, he suggested I give AA a try. And he suggests I start getting on my knees and thank God for keeping me sober each day. By that time, I had 30 or 40 days sober. going to meetings just about every day. And I'm like, I'm cursing. What did God ever do for me? What did, what is AA going to do? And he asked me, well, do you have any better ideas? I was pretty struck speechless about that time, and I decided to give it a try. So I sobered up in Southern Cal, in the Newhall area, in the Valencia area, and my home group down there is the Rafters group there in Newhall, and 38 meetings a week, and still with the same employer. My employer asked me if I'd like to transfer up to the Central Valley. We had another employee vacating a spot, and I asked him, why did he pick me? And he said, well, you're field service tech, repair commercial appliances. And he said, you're the only one we could trust. So how do you go from the drunken, most untrustworthy employee, where they couldn't let me out of their sight? They had teletrack on my truck, and they were tracking my movements, and they knew every liquor store I stopped by, and they knew all my movements, and now they could trust me? How does that happen? It's only made possible through what I've learned here, to be a trustworthy employee. Start being a decent dad. Go to work and stop, you know, because I was heavy-handed with my kids. Heavy disciplinarian, and said, stop disciplining your kids that way. And I started learning new ways of, I guess, people interactions. I'm still a work in progress in that area, because generally my interactions with others wind up in confrontations often. More often than not, lately, since I sobered up and started practicing the steps, you know, learned some tools like the 11th step, and pause when agitated. That's a pretty good tool. I don't have to tailgate the other motorists out on the highway until their next exit. Things like that. You know, I was about 12 years sober, and I had a judge ask me, please take your foot off the accelerator and learn how to use the brake a little bit and stop following other motorists so close. Because if you don't, you're going to probably wind up riding the bus because you won't have a driver's license anymore. I don't always learn my lessons by just following other people's good examples. I have to learn my lessons by my bad examples at times. And probably since I've sobered up, I've had as many bad examples of being sober as good examples. I've been a pretty bad example at times. Even in the past couple of years since I've been up here, I've been a pretty bad example at times. Still a work in progress. But I see a lot of Bridge Street people here tonight. And Mitch was the first one to welcome me at Bridge Street, and I started going to the morning meetings over there at Bridge Street, some of the evening meetings, and sometimes my work, depending on what time I have to start or how many hours a day I work. Sometimes I make the morning meetings or I make the evening meetings. And even the Alano Club over there, I make meetings over there. And some of the other meetings around town. And I really enjoy the sobriety here in the Central Valley. Not that the sobriety was bad in the Santa Clarita area. That's one thing my sponsor had me do prior to even making my decision to move up here. He said, go to some meetings, see if you like it there. See if you like going to the meetings. He said, he's known people that moved out of the areas where they live and they weren't comfortable going to meetings in the area that they moved into. I don't know, so I started going to Bridge. I felt at home there, and I started to get to know some of the people there and going to some of the events around town. Soberfest and other events, get-togethers that we have at times, and going out to dinner once in a while when I don't have an early start time. It's all been made possible by the process of completing the process of going through the steps, doing an inventory, and continuing to do the spot check inventory, the 10th, the 11th, and 12th. The 11th step, I was taught to practice that. I read it out of the big book, and I ask specific questions at night when we retire at night. And do I have any amends to make? And upon awakening, given some clear cut directions on what to do. I have probably two or three sponsors. I still have one in Southern Cal. I have one a sponsor up here in the Central Valley that I communicate with often. And a couple other cities. I've even pulled some I've heard about people pulling geographics, moving from one city to the next. And someone handed me a card when I was new, and he said, on the card, it says, "Wherever you go, there you are." And even I've done that in meetings, and not like one meeting, going to the next meeting or move to another city to go to a different meeting. And the common denominator, I'm always there. So, it was suggested to me, try to see what you can bring to the meeting rather than take from the meeting. Are there any newcomers there? Can you help? Is there anybody there you can help out? When I keep that in mind, I seem to be a lot more at peace. But the big book, I wouldn't read page 62 for a long time, and then top of the page, or the second paragraph, is the selfishness and self-centeredness that we think is the root of our trouble. And I didn't think that was the root of my trouble. You know, but I used to live in a lot of denial. First it was with my drinking, and then it was with my selfishness and self-centeredness. And I even sometimes live in denial on who I need to make an amends to, whether, because I feel justified sometimes being angry at people, and some may be justified of being angry at me for my behavior, because my behavior is not always an upstanding citizen or upstanding friend. Still a work in progress in a lot of areas, but one of my sons, he told me, I was about 7 years sobriety, he had told me that there wasn't anything in his life where he thought that would make him think that I was his father. And that hurt really bad. You know, it brought me to tears. And I'm like, what do you mean I'm taking you to these football practices and football games? I'm doing this and doing that. He says, "Yeah, but you're still an asshole." This is from a 13-year-old. Today he calls me up or texts me. He's 22 now, and tells me that he loves me, and he's proud that I'm his dad, that made some changes in my life. And, thanks, Rick, for asking me to speak just before I walked in the door. If I would have had a month to think about it. That's what we get here. We come in and we share what's going on with us today. We can share from the heart. And, usually when I have a long time to think about it, then I usually share more of my opinion and my thinking. And, there was a time where I was told to go chase the newcomers or go help out the newcomers. So I was 7 or 8 years sober. I always carried a big book under my arm and chase after the newcomers. And there were a couple times where, rather than carry the message, I'd kind of coerce the message a little bit, and got a couple guys pissed off at me. And one guy even I was trying to help him, and he didn't want to listen. He was a newcomer. He was kind of still had his own ideas, and I told him to shut his effing mouth, and he punched me. So I got to be careful what I say to people because I don't know where their frame of mind is. And he got 86 from the group because they didn't allow any physical contact. But things like that, I try to think of how could I handle it differently or rephrase it so that I wouldn't have got punched because, one, he was an amateur boxer. He was about 6 inches taller than me. His reach was about 4 inches longer, so there's no way that I could have even defended myself, really. That's what alcohol used to do to me. It changed my perception. I'm short, kind of quiet. Put a couple shots at me, then I just become braver and more brazen and mouthy, and I wound up blocking a lot of punches in my face. I mean, wound up with a lot of black eyes, and I don't know. If you're new here tonight and you're, I can't speak enough about Alcoholics Anonymous and how it's changed this alcoholic's life, and it's changed millions of people's lives over the years and, for the better. It's, if you're new tonight or newer and you're hurting and you feel like quitting, maybe you don't think this is for you, this one old timer, his name was he called himself Kahui Louie. He said, "Keep your head out of your ass." Louie is what his nickname was. And he would always finish up his pitch with, "Don't leave 5 minutes before the miracle happens." The miracle for this alcoholic, and I haven't had a drink in all day, and I don't even want to drink. I haven't even, it tells us in the big book that we haven't even sworn it off. We feel like we've been placed in a position of neutrality when it, so long as we continue a daily reprieve, contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual conditioning. And I don't often do that or always do that. There's days where I slip up or I get up and find out I'm late for work and I don't practice meditation or read the daily readings or say my prayers before I go to bed, thanking God for keeping me sober that day. More often than not, I do. And more often than not, I live peacefully. And I can sleep at night. I don't know. I thank Rick and thank you all for being here tonight. Thank you for asking me to speak. I didn't hear the timer, so I apologize.
Okay, ladies and gentlemen, let's give a warm Tulare County welcome for our featured speaker, Paul. All right.
Wow. My name is Paul. I'm an alcoholic. I was separated from alcohol for the last time on the 17th of November, 1976. And what I was like that Wednesday morning in Underhill, Vermont, what I'm like this, what's it, Friday, here in Visalia. If I don't think about that honestly, I don't think I could stay sober. And if it wasn't for what I was like when I came to Vermont, or when I came to AA, was I had no place else to go. I had a really good job, had a nice house, same wife, three kids, pillar of the community, more time in church than most priests. Asked me to be a politician back there. I would have fixed Bernie Sanders, I guess. But I was graduated from college on my 21st birthday. The Congress made me an officer and a gentleman. I was married. And I was a poster boy. I wouldn't say shit if I had a mouthful. Wouldn't cheat on an exam. Was a virgin when I got married. I had 16 years of Catholic education. Thank God. And when I got into AA, the bishop in Burlington had an assistant in AA, and he said to me one time, he said, you know, Paul, what my claim to fame is? I never spent a day in Catholic school. That's great, Father. You know, if I hadn't had that background, I would never have survived Alcoholics Anonymous. So the book says that we are undisciplined. That's the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous I'm talking about. So we let God discipline us. Well, thank God that didn't apply to me. I've been on a drill team since I was in Cub Scouts. I took orders very well. I was raised by Irish immigrants in Boston because the mother made the mistake of marrying a New Hampshire Protestant Republican, which was totally verboten. And when that marriage came to an end, she didn't even know it came to an end, I understand. I was told he was dead. And his mother said that you married him for his money, so you bring them up in our religion and you'll go to Harvard like he did. He didn't stay there long. And otherwise, hit the road. And so my mother went back to her father, and he simply told her that, hey, we told you about this. Now, you can come home, but you're going to eat shit. And I was 5 years old, maybe. And I was lost. I was totally lost. And I had no idea how lost I was. And I grew up with 26 cousins. And the business of being from a single parent family where I come from is a no-no, major league no-no. And I can remember people saying things like, what's he need to drive his license for? He hasn't got a father. What's he need to go to college for? There weren't a lot of people, it seemed to me, that had much value on me. And when I do my inventory today, I see how little value I have on me. So when I got out of the service, I went back to Vermont. I was offered a job with the Las Vegas Parole and Probation Department. My last station in the Air Force was Fallon, Nevada, commanding Air Force officer on a Navy base. I mean, Jesus, that was, I've always been in the wrong place. But I ended up thinking, and I went over to Carson City, and I ran into this guy. He says, man, he says, you're the guy I want to put this job down there. He says, now I'm going to give you this book, and I want you to give it back to me. You don't have to worry, because I'm going to fix it. You're going to have the job. You're the guy I want. So I was finally, wow, excited. And I went home, and I told the good wife. And several days later, I said, hey, where's that book? I threw it away. Oh, God. And back to Vermont I went. I never forgave that woman for doing that. And for the first 15 years of my recovery, and she's the person that got me into AA, whenever I was speaking, you were treated to an hour of that woman who had a mouth bigger than Galway Bay and was the bane of my existence. And yet, without a psychic change, there is little or no hope for permanent recovery. You know, today I love that woman. I don't have anything to say to her. I don't want to ever see her again. But I pray for her all the time. Now, for someone who lived in the world of hate that I lived in, to turn it into, I can think loving thoughts about that woman today, it's a psychic change. And so when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous and I heard the word psychic change, or spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, I said, oh well, you know, I'll do the work, I'll bust my ass, and when it comes time for the goodies, I'll get left out. I mean, this was an attitude that I had. And so I went to work for a company called National Gypsum, and I was the youngest sales representative in the entire company, and I worked for the son of the owner of the founder of the company, and he told me I was too young to be doing what I was doing. And I had the war cry of all alcoholics, just tell me something and I'll show you. And I did. I became the top dog from the state of Vermont. Busting my ass, lying, drinking, whoring, all kinds of stuff. And all of that lifestyle was what brought me to my bottom. It brought me to the spiritual bottom where I once looked up to. The only reason I got into the college that I graduated from is the principal of the school wrote me up as an outstanding Catholic leader. And I had gone from that exalted position to that Wednesday morning when I had no place else to go. So I came to Alcoholics Anonymous that Wednesday looking for a place to hide out. There was a place in the town I lived in called Maple Leaf Farm. And it was up in the hills. And I went up there one day and there was this big building and all these flags flying and people walking around, and I went home and I said to the wife, I said, you know, they got a maple syrup factory up there in the hills. You know, other places they have a still, but Vermont, we were really, you know. And she says, no, you dummy, that's a drunk tank. Oh. And then on Saturday night, she took me by the ear, and off I went. Now, for a Boston Irish Catholic like myself, that doesn't happen. The greatest disgrace that could possibly happen to me with my background.
Who wears the pants in that family?
And if you were on the other side of that equation, if you weren't shit already, you were really totally shit now. Now, you asked me why I drank. Because the first half a glass of Knickerbocker beer when I was 13 years old was wunderbar. Oh, God, there was that feeling of power. I just loved that 13 years old, that feeling of power. And I was sitting with the extended family. We had barn raisins at our house every weekend. Jesus, I hated every damn one of them. Resentment is the number one offender. Kills more alcoholics than anything else. Well, yeah, but do you have any resentments, Paul? No. Jesus, that's what I was like, and now that's all I talk about is my resentments. But then something else happened that I wasn't aware of. I was under the impression with all my religious education that according to my Bible, if you're an alcoholic, you're going to hell for the sin of gluttony. Now, in Alcoholics Anonymous, they talk about this being a disease. Now, I sure as hell didn't want to go to hell. I spent a lot of time making sure I wasn't going there. I didn't like the thought of that. And here I am, an alcoholic, left my wife, took up with another woman, got thrown out of the rectory. See to it, Jot, your relationship with him is right, and great things will happen. Oh, yeah. Christ, if I wasn't running then, I was running fast afterwards looking for some kind of relief. I went through merciless hell because I learned how to do my inventory and I learned how to find out where I was at fault. I spent a lot of time in church. I never got sober there. I've spent a lot of time in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I've been abstinent from alcohol ever since. So put the round peg in the round hole, Paul. Wow. Put the round peg in the round hole. How can it be that simple? How can it be that simple? And then go to AA meetings and hear, surrender. Love that one. Well, what's that mean? Just the other night, I was going through some fun stuff with myself and my higher power. We have a little better relationship now. I become more willing to listen to AA when it's AA and church when it's church. I become more willing to do that. But then I have to constantly remember that I'm not cured of this disease. I only have a daily reprieve based on fit spiritual condition. Well, how can I be in fit spiritual condition when I can't even look at the crucifix on the wall? Whew. And my sister, PhD in theology, Sister Mary Piety. Oh, God. Yeah, I haven't been back to Boston since 1988. I still can't go back. I've been banished. I'm the man without a country. I live here in the state of banished. And then somebody says, well, God loves you, Paul. Yes, he certainly does. he certainly has a strange way of... I can remember my drunk. She's an alcoholic. She wanted to be like her dad, so she became an alcoholic. She's sober 7 years now, living in a commune in New Mexico, doing the Buddhist thing. This is her fourth trip through. And she's right back to the crystal and the wicker and the Buddhism and hallelujah. Her girlfriend's a recovering alcoholic, but the two of them don't need meetings. I mean, golly gee, they're so much better than all that. And I think, God, how lucky I am that I haven't found a diversion from Alcoholics Anonymous. Because as soon as I get a resentment, I find a diversion. I'm out of here. And the longer I think about the things I'm talking about, the longer, the more time I have to spend in that 10-step inventory. Why do I feel like this? And the damnedest answer is restlessness, irritability, and discontent. Well, when you're 41 plus years sober, you can't be this way. I mean, what do they think? What do they say about you? Well, you know, that guy's like Jesus. But the funny thing is, I'm still here. And I have to think, where am I at fault? And it's the thinking. The stinking thinking that leads to drinking, it never goes away. At least it hasn't for me. And then comes the spiritual malady. I don't go to around people that talk about, I'm an asshole. That's one of the causes of me needing to pick up a drink. I don't want to be that. But then again, where am I at fault? I'm very gullible. If you tell me, you know, Paul, you're really something. You are the cat's ass.
Whoa, get away.
But if you say, hey, piece of shit, over here, coming. That self, no self. And in the inventory process, we look at the instincts that God gave us, the self-esteem, the ambition, the relationships, the pocketbook. Wow, the things I find out about me. You know, I'm finally willing to admit that my life is unmanageable. How's that for a long time sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous? He got by the first step. No, I don't tell too many people that. They get the wrong idea, you know. But I'm so glad I finally understand it. And why? Why do I have all of these things going on? Because I don't want to ever pick up another drink again. And I'm blessed with the worst damn thing that ever happened to me since I've been sober, and that's a drunk dream. Jesus, there's nothing nicer than a drunk dream to wake up with a willy billy. My God, did I do it? Oh, God. It takes a long time for me to come out of that nosedive. But then again, you know, I never believed that if I picked up a drink today, it wouldn't be like I haven't had a drink from 41 years and I got a fresh start. It'd be as if I never stopped. I heard stuff like that in AA when I was a little smarter than I am now, and there was smell in the room. God, it was awful. But those days I didn't have the experience that those people had. And today I have the experience. When somebody talks about a drunk dream, I don't say,
oh, you're in trouble.
Because it's a drunk dream that lets me see just how sick I am to this day. And how much I need a relationship. See to it that your relationship with him is right. Without that relationship with him, I wouldn't survive. I got lost on my way to the meeting tonight. What annoys you the most, Paul? Your inability to find out where you're supposed to go. I put 5 compasses in my car back east. And Vermont's all north and south. And I fight with the compass. And drink. And smoke my cigarette and turn on my 8-track doo-wop tape. 5 feet of snow. Heaven. Total heaven. But the goddamn compass. Always wrong. I've lived in the same house, I say here, since 1982. I still get lost on the way home. I got lost tonight. Now, when those things happen, my feelings, how do these things affect me? That's the third column in that inventory. Ah, yes. I have no hope. And I remember being at an AA meeting back in Rutland, Vermont, one Wednesday night, and the subject was hope. I was like 2 years sober, and I was sitting in that meeting when my turn came to talk. I said, you know, glad I'm not drinking. But I can tell you this. I hate Vermont. I hate my wife. And I hate my job. But the only way I'm getting out of this state is feet first. I have no hope. Well, a year later, the wife was gone. A year later, Vermont was gone. And the job was gone. And I was coming to California. Hallelujah. There is a God. It's going to be the Beach Boys and Beach Blanket Bingo and Annette and holy doody, la-ti-da. Yeah. I was in Visalia one night. And I had a remarkable change of, oh, Jesus. And that poor woman that I came to Visalia with, my God, she was a saint. In fact, when she divorced me in 1990, she said to me, in the 15 years I've known you, you've got worse. I felt bad about that. Really felt bad about it. And then I thought about, well, wait a minute. This is the purpose of doing that inventory. Why do you feel bad, Paul? Well, when she met you, you were a year sober, and you were easy. 15 years later, you developed a little backbone. You know that the word no is a complete sentence. What part don't you understand? By now, you might have a few boundaries. Things like, well, I don't think she liked that. I really think that that was the problem. I had learned to say no. And when you're owned and operated by another person, they don't like that. And so that was the end of that. And then I went to live with myself for 10 years. That was a fun time. You know, waiting for God. There's somewhere it says waiting on the Lord. Waiting for God. Don't do anything until it's time. It's time. No, it ain't. When I was 10 years old, it was time for me to drive a car. Buggers made me wait till I was 16. I don't know what was wrong with them. I had a resentment against them too, I guess. It's always my time. This time. And then there's God's time. That's why my life is unmanageable. When I want something, I want it. And I'm ready, Freddy. And then I got this higher power that says, no, you ain't. And then the battle begins. And then we come to surrender. Wonderful surrender. And just the other night, I figured out what surrender was. Let go and let God. God, it's on every wall in every AA meeting. How many times did I look at let go and let God? For what? What's God done for me? I've lost my family. I've lost my children. I've lost my home. I've lost my job. I've lost my dog. I didn't get another job for 8 years. 8 years I went without a job. And people in AA said, you know, you have a full-time job. It's getting sober. Not with my ego, you don't. So all of a sudden, 1985, this lady in AA says, Paul, why don't you go over to the unemployment office? What for? I've been there 100 times. So I took a suggestion. Every now and then I do that. They suggest you take a suggestion. And when I went into the office, the guy looks at me and he says, what are you doing here? We ain't got nothing for you. I said, yeah, I know. And I left. And 3 days later, I was working for the California Lottery. And then I could see the Cadillac and the television and the appearances and the la-di-da. Oh, Jesus. What did I do? Out. You know, there's a joke we used to have in the lottery. The guy won the lottery. He comes home and says, I hit the lottery. And he goes upstairs and she says, where are you going? I'm going to pack. She says, where are you going? I ain't going anywhere. You are. and that's the beauty that I understood. When I am self-sufficient, I don't need anybody. It's when I'm down and dirty that I need you people. But when I'm flying high, and anybody that looks at me cross-eyed, when I'm prosperous, hit the road, Jack. Now, how can I be spiritually fit with the kind of attitudes that I'm talking about? Well, because I've been able to identify these attitudes, I've been able to ask God to remove them if he wants to in step seven. And I've heard so many people talk about how difficult that is. And why do I want to remove them? Because I'm sick and tired of being sick and tired of my attitude towards me. And back there in the great state of snow, the roads were always 10 feet of snow, ice, me drunk on a back road. Next thing you know, I destroyed another car. They called me Bonnie Oldfield back there. And they decided that they wouldn't give me a red card no more. Because that was the problem. The fact that I was always drunk didn't seem to bother them. And as I would drive down the road, and I would go under these underpasses with the big cement poles, I often wondered which one of those poles got my name on it. I didn't care. I didn't care about me. And that was the spiritual malady I had. I never cared about me. And what I'm like today is I take pretty damn good care of me. I'm 76 years old, and when I tell people that, they say, huh? You can't be that age. You look too good to be that age. Yes, dear. But I'm the same guy who'll turn right around and say, I have no reason to be grateful. And I remember Perry. He was an alcoholic who's dead now, if I say a guy for a long time. And he used to say, you know, you don't find too many 55-year-old drunks walking the streets. You know, and here I am at my ripe age today, active as hell, crazier than ever, and actually sometimes doing what the big book Alcoholics Anonymous says, insist on enjoying life. And I do it by, I have some respect for myself today. I've gained some self-respect. I play golf every week with my wife over in Exeter. And they got a little clique over there that I didn't fit in with. She did, because she's beautiful. She fits in with anybody. But I don't. And so they gave me some shit one day. I never went back. You know, I go to an AA meeting, I get some shit, I never go back. But what I do is I find another meeting. And if I can't find another meeting, I start a meeting. And before I, in 1990, there weren't any morning meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous in Visalia. So me and another guy were out running every morning. We had to get in shape now that we're single. And that's how the 7 o'clock ABC group got started. After we finished running, we ended up down at the Alamo Club having a cup of coffee, and pretty soon there was a group. And when that group got a little, the group conscience wasn't in play anymore, another group. And then came the 10-step group out of that. And I've been a member of that 10-step group now since 1990. Every single week, we get that board out. We stand there in front of that board, and we put that inventory right up there. And by golly, I like to see what a scamp I am. I like to finally understand why I did the shit I did. And sometimes I'm so proud of myself. I'm just so proud of myself. You know, the old John Paul Jones, I think he said it best, don't tread on me. You know, and that's one thing that Alcoholics Anonymous has given me. I don't have to take shit from anybody anymore. I finally got to the place where I have a self. And I can sit back and thank God that every single thing that's happened to me in my life worked for good. Although I wouldn't have told you that at the time. But that's what that spiritual awakening is as a result of the steps. Without the discipline I had, without the hard life and all the things that I had, it developed my character. It gave me some backbone. It talks about that in the book of Alcoholics Anonymous. It says when it comes to character building, we weren't interested. And why didn't I care about me? And why didn't I care about my life? Because I had no self-respect. I had lost that self-respect. And that spiritual bankruptcy that comes with that. And what I'm like today, I have some of that self-respect back. And I like it. And I think of the old cowboy movies. The old days, the cowboys would be out there, and the other guys would grab them, and they'd take them back to the lodge, and they all line up with their tomahawks and shit and make the guy run through. That's called the gauntlet. Most of the time, I think I'm in a bloody gauntlet. One more trip through. But I always come out on the other side. I might have to buy a white hat before I'm done. For a guy who's had a terrible life, one of the things that happened to me in Visaya, God really gave me a screw when he sent me here, was that I needed a job before the lottery came. And there was a company called Textan Boot and Saddle. So I applied for that job. And I was the only Boston Irish Catholic cowboy that had the whole goddamn company. And they used to drag me down to Yoakum, Texas, just to hear me talk. And they dragged me off to Caesar's Palace to do shows and shit like that with the hat and the rag and all the boots and shit. And I was the top damn salesman in the company. So more saddles than 1 year than anybody else. And here I am saying, what a screwing I got. So where is the psychic change? How do I get out of that what a screwing I got? And what an adventure I had. What an adventure I had. How many kids, snot-nosed kids like me, growing up in the streets of Boston, a refugee, a single-parent family, poor me, alas and alack, no hope, would end up going off on these screwball adventures that I've gone off on. And I can say I have no reason to be grateful. Because I hate normal. I'll tell you right now, normal isn't my thing. I never want to be that. I like being me and doing the things that I do. And being unpredictable as hell. My poor wife, God bless her, she came here from Vermont. She didn't know. Came in on the tide, I guess. And she didn't like cowboys and farmers, so I was the only game in town. And she's been married to me now for 10 years, I think. And she still looks at me strange. Well, Vasislos, I mean, gee whiz. And I like that. I do like that. It tickles me. When I was drinking, nothing tickled me. I love the drink. I love the doo-wop. I love the cigarettes. I love the snowy road. I love the ski lodge. And the damnedest thing was, she was in that ski lodge when I was there. She never paid for a drink in her life. God, did I hate her. Yeah. And here I was. I only had like $5. And it's pretty tough to get drunk on $5, but I could be thrifty, I guess. And I thought to myself, with all the resentments I have, now you're here in Visalia, and you're all desperate. Huh. It's payback. So I married him. And we've been married for 10 years. That really astounds me. And the poor woman, she listens to AA from 7 to 8 every morning. Get out the book, listen to the spiritual side of AA every morning. And that's why we're still married. Because at 8 o'clock at night, I can't talk about the things at 8 o'clock at night that have got my attention during the day. At 7 o'clock in the morning, I'm not hungry, angry, lonely, or tired. So now, I can be reasonable. Gee, what a wonderful thing it is to be reasonable. And yet, a divorce lawyer told me, if you do that, you'll be judged unreasonable. What do you mean? I'm a sober alcoholic. I'm a guru. I've been around for a long time. I'm spiritual as hell. What do you mean saying something like that to me? And I had a psychiatrist tell me the same thing. He said, you've lived in your head all your life. And that information is going to start moving down to your heart. And it's going to be a painful trip. It's a good thing I didn't know what he was talking about. And I was on the seventh floor in this hospital that I checked into. And I noticed that all the windows were only this wide. They're like the windows in Las Vegas. They're only that wide. And now I know why. Because if I'd known what that guy was telling me back then, I'd have gone out that window. Sometimes trudging the road of happy destiny isn't my cup of tea. But then again, I like the results. I'm happy that I was able to find this place tonight. I had to ask God, because I trust him like I trust nobody else. And I'm sure he let me down again. And now, how am I going to face this embarrassment? What am I going to do to handle that? And that's a familiar place for me to be. So I did something I never do. I asked for help. I never stop and ask for directions. I'm better than that. If I'm lost, I'm lost. I wouldn't ask anybody for the time of day. Yet, in the book of Alcoholics Anonymous, it tells us that pride, it's not by accident that pride leads the pack. The pack of what? The causes and conditions that'll set me up for the resentment that'll bring me back to the first drink. And once I do that, just like that very first drink I had when I was 13 years old, that half a glass of beer, I developed the phenomenon of craving. I wanted more. And they wouldn't give it to me. So I was angry. I don't think I had another drink for another 5 years. So the only difference between my first drink at 13 and my last drink at 35 was how far down the ladder I went. How far into the pit of self-hate, self-loathing, self-deprecation, how far down I went. With all the things that I had in my life, with all the benefits that I was blessed to have, when I came here, that's where I was. And I don't want to go back there. So, it's grow or go. Whenever I'm disturbed, there's something wrong with me. I was pretty damn disturbed tonight when I got lost. So I asked God for help. I stayed disturbed. But then I asked a guy on the street for help. I had asked two or three different people. There's a lot of churches in this town. But unfortunately for you people, I found a place. I mean, you could have heard something worthwhile tonight. Jesus, I think if I had to sit and listen to someone like me, I'd have a terrible case of assitis. Jesus, that guy ever shut up? No. There was a doctor in AA when I came to Visalia, And I was envious of hell. That's another one of those little things that you find in the big book, envy. Because he was a doctor with all kinds of money, a young wife, and this, that, and the other thing. And he looked at me one day and he said, "You son of a bitch." I said, "What?" He says, "Here I am. I open my mouth and nothing comes out. Here you are. You open your mouth and a million words come out." Jesus. Well, I had no value. So anything I had no value. You cannot give away what you haven't got. And I found how true that is. I had no love for myself. So how the hell was I going to give love to somebody else? I didn't care about my life, so why would I care about anybody else? The only thing I ever cared about is what can you do for me? That was the thing that I spent most of my time drinking. Because I never drank at home, I only drank on the road. And I was always in a nice hotel with a lot of other traveling reps looking to see if they would say, "Wow." And I remember one guy who worked for a cigarette company. He said, "Man," he says, "I'd love to hire you. But there's no way I could channel your energy." "What are you talking about?" "I'll take the job." "Now, give me an airplane ticket, heaven on earth. Airplane ticket, a drink, and come back home 3 days later in detox." I went home every weekend. I left the house every Tuesday, came home every Wednesday, Friday. And what I realized today is the reason I came home every Friday was I needed to detox. And yet, I'm the same guy that would walk down the street and go into a detox and say, "Ooh, what am I doing in here?" And then that identification, identify, don't compare. I can identify. 2 minutes. That's cool. Gee, boy, you lucky buggers.
I got three.
All right. Anyway, thank you for asking me to do this. I appreciated it. And that's the only thing that I have to say. Whenever anyone, anywhere asks for help, I want the hand of AA to be there. Thank you.
Thank you.